From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Federal Small Business Administration says it's run out of payroll protection program money. Today on the show, we check in with a few small business owners to see how they're doing.
It's down to just me. Everyone else is on unemployment, so I'm keeping the online sales going, and it was certainly scary for a bit.
Another business owner coins a phrase we can all relate to in this moment.
You know, we've been calling this quarantine brain. I feel like my brain is especially fractured right now.
Also today, celebrated Ojibwe poet Lois Beardsley helps root us to the ground.
You know, I've been told all my life, be patient. People of color, you need to be patient now. You know, America has to grow into change. And then seeing that, well, actually, change only happens if you keep pushing, pushing, pushing.
That and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We want to come back to a subject we talked about at this time yesterday. Now, if you were with us, you'll recall we covered a protest in Lansing that jammed the streets. This protest was convened in the name of businesses suffering under the COVID-19 quarantine. But the protest ended up drawing people from a whole array of right-wing causes, including some white supremacist groups. And it got us thinking. There are so many small businesses struggling, finding ways to make it work. What would they ask for? We also know that today the Small Business Administration announced it's run through the $349 billion allotted for its Paycheck Protection Program. In the weeks to come, we're going to cross the map of Michigan, devoting some space to business under quarantine. Please do reach out if you have a story. We're going to start things off in Grand Rapids with Dan Boyles. He's the co-owner of a gift shop called Rebel.
Thank you for having me.
Will you tell us a little bit about the shop?
So we're a small gift shop, about 1,800 square feet, and we carry greeting cards and candles and books and all kinds of different gifts.
So how are things going with inventory in the store right now?
Just to give you an example of what happened this morning, puzzles have been a lifeline for people. If we can get a puzzle in, we can sell it. And I placed a huge order about 2.5 weeks ago from one of our regular vendors. They just shipped us what they could, which meant I had to buy in large quantities versus how I normally do, because they have to ship in these huge caseloads so that they can limit how many people are in their factory. We just got those puzzles dropped off in our driveway a few minutes ago, and it changed the entire trajectory of our day, because we're like, oh my gosh, something that people want, we have to get it photographed. So that means that I have to take 4 or 5 different products, take them to my photographer who is in quarantine. She has to photograph those products, upload them to the site, then we have to pick those products back up from her driveway and then quarantine them. And then, like, the other products that are in back stock, end up going onto the site right away. And that's the difference between whether or not we're getting business. And then, like I said, you know, I've had other companies that are in states that are not in shelter in place that don't really understand what's going on. And so they're being, they're having a hard time understanding that they need to ship it to our home address as opposed to the store, because we're not at the store most of the time. Other manufacturers have products that are sitting in containers in the harbor in New York. We have no idea when those things will get here. So anything that I can get, I said the other day, I feel like I'm selling at the, you know, market in Hunger Games, where I, oh my gosh, we just got a puzzle, you know. How can we get this to you? We've even had a pretty frank conversation. We have two storefronts. We had just opened a new concept a few blocks down the weekend that the shelter in place happened. And so we've had a very frank conversation that we may only be able to open one storefront because we may not be able to have enough inventory to open both stores. And it's right. going to probably take me until September to fill the store back to the capacity that we had 4 weeks ago.
You've been trying to apply for some of the relief money that's available from the federal government. Do you want to fill us in on what loans you've applied for and just what the process has been like?
I have applied or contacted my banking institution about applying for the payroll protection loan that's available. And that was the one that seemed that would be most useful to us during this time.
If I can just jump in and explain, this is something that the Small Business Administration makes available, as people might imagine from the name of the loan, to help businesses keep their employees at least partially paid, if not fully paid, during the shutdown.
Yes. You know, we have such a wonderful team that had come into place. And so it's been important for us to try to support our employees as much as possible while also supporting ourselves. And so this grant money was is something that's available to help us to recoup some cost with rent and with that payroll. I've found just through our financial institution that within the first week, they received over 30,000 requests for this grant. And, you know, I'm a realist. They told me that they were not accepting any more loan applications and that they would put me on a waiting list. And since then, I've talked to a couple other small business owners who have spent, you know, hours and hours and days trying to jump through the hoops to get this money secured and to apply for these grants. And we've just decided at this point, it makes more sense for us to try to move forward and to help ourselves and to try to figure out how to get some business going via our online retail store that we created in this emergency.
If you could wave a magic wand and change the application process, what would you do?
There are so many fears that we're all facing. It's hard just to do the basic things that need to be done each day. You know, we've been calling this quarantine brain. I feel like my brain is especially fractured right now as it comes to just doing the basic tools. So I would love very much if there was a way for us to just be able to go on a website that didn't seem like you were basically giving away all of your personal information to something on the internet that you have no idea if you're ever going to get a response or not. So if there was a way through, you know, the state of Michigan or through the federal government for us to be able to go all to the same place and apply all at the same place, it would just, to me, that seems better than me trying to frantically run around and try to find a bank that hasn't been overwhelmed in order to get secured for some of this assistance.
As you mentioned, in the midst of trying to deal with loans or grant possibilities, you've also been trying to make this rapid pivot to online store. Before this, I think Rebel was brick and mortar only, right?
It was. You know, we've always kind of had pride in the fact that we were a Grand Rapids store and that people that lived in the city were proud to have this place that they could bring their friends and family and that it was a special place to kind of, you know, to come to when you were in town. And there's so many reasons why we opened our business in the beginning. And most of those reasons had to do with people and relationships and community. And so the online presence just sort of seemed, I don't know, almost like the enemy. You know, we're constantly having a conversation about things like Amazon and you know, with technology and people's phones being so readily available. It's a lot easier to do that. But what we've always experienced is that people love the process of coming in, and our customers are our friends and our neighbors and people that, you know, bring their dogs in. And so that's always been a big part of our initial goal. Obviously, in this crisis, it's become more about providing some comfort and some level of normalcy for people. So that's been, I've been telling people that our retail front right now looks like a combination between a war room and an Amazon fulfillment center. So it's, you know, it's been going as well as can be expected. We're nowhere near financially where we would be if we had our brick and mortar store open. You know, Mother's Day weekend is coming up. That's like our number two holiday. So things like that.
What do small businesses need from their communities most right now? Or maybe, you know, if there's anyone in a decision-making capacity hearing this right now from lawmakers?
I think the thing that we need most is just a little bit more clarity on what we are allowed to do You know, there have been, because all of this happened so quickly and we all had to pivot on a dime, I feel like there's just a lot of uncertainty and just what it looks like for us. You know, we're looking at this deadline in a couple of weeks where supposedly we'll be able to go back to some sense of business, but we don't know what that means. Like, what does that look like for a retail store? How many people will we be able to have in the store? How will we check out customers in a social distancing setting? You know, these are things that if we had some sense of what was going to happen next, we could plan instead of being kind of dumped into this again.
What are your concerns about that recovery process?
Well, you know, just on a practical level, a typical Saturday at Rebel looks like 50 to 75 people at all times in the store with dogs and kids and strollers. And I just know that that's not going to be a reality in a world where social distancing may have to be our norm for the next, you know, year or so. And so I guess that's the thing that I'm the most concerned about. What does it look like to have products that really people shouldn't be touching? And what does it look like for my staff to have to be not only doing a great job with customer service and ringing up customers in a busy store, but also keeping everything sterilized?
Is there anything that's making you feel optimistic at the moment? It's okay to say no, if that's the honest answer.
You know, I am by nature kind of a pessimistic person. And the thing that I have seen through this that has taught me to look at things differently is just that there's a sense that people are strong and that our community is strong. We have been absolutely overwhelmed by people reaching out to us, trying to show us care and support in any way they can. And especially at a time when I'm very aware that positioning having a retail store where we're selling things like puzzles and candles are not necessities for people, and that there are people that don't know how they're going to afford to pay for their mortgages and for their food. So I've just been so happy to see that sense of community remain and not only remain, but seem as though we're going to come out of this stronger. So that's been very encouraging to me.
Well, Dan, thank you so much and good luck with the store.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure to speak with you today, April.
That's Dan Boyles, one of the owners of Rebel in Grand Rapids. In just a moment, we're going to hear from some other entrepreneurs in Marquette and Traverse City. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with some small business owners around Michigan about how things are going, their challenges, and what they need right now if they're to survive the COVID-19 shutdown. We're glad to hear from you if you have a story to share. Let's move on to Marquette, where the world was just starting to wake up from winter when the virus hit. Bugsy Saylor is the founder of the Upper Peninsula Supply Company. Bugsy Saylor, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, can you give us a sense of the size of UP Supply Company before the virus hit?
Yeah, so we're a small operation. I mean, I would say we're a micro business. It's me, one business partner, and one employee, and usually an intern. So that's it. And we have our online operation and then our retail brick and mortar store downtown Marquette.
Could you describe your product line for us?
Yeah, so Upper Peninsula Supply Company, we have Upper Peninsula screen printed t-shirts, you know, stickers and prints and posters. A good chunk of it is designed in-house, and then we work with other local designers as well.
And how long have you been in business?
We've been in business for 12 years now.
What happened to your sales when the shutdown happened?
I mean, we shuttered our doors for the store. So, you know, that went down to a flat zero. And it's down to just me. Everyone else is on unemployment. So I'm keeping the online sales going. And it was certainly scary for a bit in terms of the business. But we had a big successful online push, which gives us some cushion for the short time anyways.
What are your concerns about the long-term outlook with this?
if I'm thinking of the business sense of it, you know, we realize that, you know, we sell Upper Peninsula goods, and we think Upper Peninsula goods are an essential need, right?
Right.
But truthfully, we understand we're at the bottom of that list in terms of essential goods. You know, when people have financial concerns right now and health concerns and everything else. So, you know, we appreciate anybody's business we can get, but we understand we're not at the top of that list right now. But for us, you know, the tourist season is incredibly, incredibly important. And we hope that, you know, hopefully the economy is rolling by summer. And it's, I think, one of our biggest concerns is how eager will people be to travel? You know, so that speaks for a lot of small businesses, you know, in communities like Marquette, you know, who really rely on that tourist traffic.
Can you give us a sense of who that extended community is for you and maybe some of the other businesses that you're concerned about?
Yeah, our shop is right downtown Marquette, and I live downtown as well. So it's really community-centered town, and downtown it's full of all – it's all locally owned shops, small restaurants, local owners, and, you know, it's a ghost town. Everything's closed. So I usually get all my work done at coffee shops, and, you know, I miss all my favorite coffee shops from Velodrome Coffee in town to The Crib and even just grabbing a muffin next door at Baby Cakes.
Marquette County has had, as of the time we're having this conversation, 27 COVID-19 cases confirmed and 5 deaths. That's not insignificant in a town of Marquette's size, but it is relatively low impact compared with what we're seeing in Detroit and Oakland County. Can you give us a sense of just what people you know make of the total shutdown of business?
Yeah, you know, I think there's certainly frustration. You know, I'm frustrated, but, you know, I'm trying to do my part to the best of my ability. And I think everybody's kind of on that page. What I think's hard for rural communities is we turn on the news and we see all the news stories are from the population centers from whatever state or country even that is being reported on. And that's where the decisions are being made as well. So it's a little harder for us to relate to that impact in a rural sense. But it took me some time to finally, you know, once I did my own research and started to understand, well, it's like there's potential for a greater impact in rural communities because we have an older population that is more at risk with fewer healthcare resources to begin with. So it's incredibly important that we don't ignore this in rural areas.
Bugsy, we understand that there's been really a lot of snow, even for the Upper Peninsula for this time of year. Would you say that getting snowed in at this point in full-on spring has compounded people's sense of really wanting to get out of the house?
Oh boy, I think that's such an interesting part of the timing of COVID is that, especially here in the Upper Peninsula, we get one nice day and like that's like everybody's got the itch. You know, you just feel that energy of everybody wants to get outside and socialize and hang out. It's just that spring energy in the longer days. So it's so bizarre to feel that and then, you know, like locked out at home. So it's difficult. But yeah, we got another foot of snow this week. Thankfully, schools were already closed and everything. So it wasn't, you know, an issue. It was kind of a little eye roll worthy, perhaps.
Bugsy, hang in there.
Thanks. You as well.
That's Bugsy Saylor of Marquette's Upper Peninsula Supply Company. We're going to check in with one last business today, this one in Traverse City, where we just got word the annual Cherry Festival has been canceled. So many of spring's pleasures just slipping through our hands. This is rough. If you're an ice cream lover, you've undoubtedly heard of Moomer's Homemade Ice Cream in Traverse City. It's a small family-run business still in operation, but you cannot stop by the farm right now and grab a scoop or two. John Plummer is part of the family that founded Moomer's and that still operates it. And he joins us now. John, I understand from the Moomer's truck. Is that where we're finding you today?
That's true. I'm actually back loading up for round two of deliveries today. So our truck is still on the road.
Will you tell us a little bit about your business?
Absolutely. So year 23 that we have been making ice cream treats and Moomer's Memories, both at the wholesale side and then, more importantly, the retail side of things when folks come out for a sweet treat with family and loved ones. So my mom, as a former first grade teacher, started it, and my middle sister Becky and I have both come on board as owners and operators and continue the Moomer's legacy in the Traverse City region.
What does work look like for you right now?
Work looks, we're happy to be working. We opened the first Friday of March with a crazy opening weekend where we handed out fast passes. It's a golden ticket, good for you and your group for a one-time use to bypass the line. Usually we have a lot of them redeemed during Cherry Festival. So now without Cherry Festival this year, you get the entire summer to redeem them. But today's work for me, we'll prep out production on Mondays where all of our orders come in. Tuesdays, I'm over in the creamery processing all of our fluid milk from our cows as whole milk, 2% milk, chocolate milk, so on and so forth. So we haven't told the cows about the COVID-19 yet, so they don't know. So they're still producing milk.
It's good to be a cow.
Tuesday and Wednesday is our production days for us. And then Wednesday and Thursday is our pretty big delivery days for us. And then, ironically, I try to take Friday off, which is weird.
How are grocery store sales going right now?
It's back to keep referring to Cherry Festival with their big news today, is it's about equivalent to the week before July 4th or Cherry Festival for their volumes. Meijer specifically is more than what they historically order during that time period, and it's now on a weekly basis.
Wait, so you're saying people are stress eating ice cream?
Stress eating is one way to term it. The other one is comfort.
Yeah.
An indulgence. Ice cream as a sweet treat. It's a memory into fun and experiences that folks have had with our product. And now they get to try to relive those memories every bite at a time at their home.
Can you give some context for those of us who may be in other parts of the state, what it means that the Cherry Festival is not going to be happening this year?
It is the largest gathering of folks in our region on a yearly basis, so much so they've brought in the Blue Angels and the Air Force Thunderbirds. And it's a huge celebration of our local industry, the cherry. We are the cherry capital of the world. And so for that to be postponed until 2021, and also the economic driver on it, will be significant. So now we get to extend O summer rather than a huge peak. I see it flattening out a little bit, and trying to be some sort of, you know, a local's summer, if you will.
Yeah.
It's a huge announcement. I'm guessing it was a hard one for them to make, being the beginning of July, but that's a decision that they had to make.
There's something about ice cream that's so social, getting it hand-scooped, handed over the counter, or at the very least, it's something we generally eat with family and friends. Do you think there's any way to make up that feeling when we're physically distant from each other?
There is. There will be. We have a few tricks up our sleeve to maintain a 6-foot distance upon reopening. We will have some cone holders where we can place that ice cream cone in a holder, slide it across the counter, and then folks can pick it up from there. So the service portion, the handing the cone to the kid, the 5-year-old kid that's jumping up and down with excitement to get an ice cream treat, may be postponed for a bit. However, the experience of ice cream running down their chin, sitting on our deck overlooking our 80-acre dairy, will continue.
Well, Mr. Plummer, thank you for your time, and please save me a pint or two of banana bread, would you?
Oh, that's a good one. I will. I will. My pleasure. Thank you.
John Plummer of Moomer's Handmade Ice Cream in Traverse City. Please reach out to us if you've got stories about how your workplace or small business is doing. You can email stateside@michiganradio.org. We're looking forward to hearing from you. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you take to the trails at Michigan State Parks to get some air and a little touch of nature in these unprecedented times, there's a woman you need to thank. Without her, Michigan's state parks might have evolved very differently. Joining us now to explain is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Rachel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
So who is this person who's been called the First Lady of Michigan State Parks?
Her name is Emma Genevieve Gillette, but throughout most of her life, she was known as Genevieve Gillette.
Where was she from? What time period was she living?
She grew up in a farm just outside of Lansing. She was born in 1898. So she came up in Ingham County in the early 20th century.
How did she get involved in state parks? I mean, at that period of time, weren't state parks a brand new concept to Americans?
They were. The state park system, the State Park Commission was founded in 1919. So we just had our centennial. And she ended up going to Michigan Agricultural College after high school. So she enrolled in 1916. And she grew up, her dad was very much into nature and they always were outside. So she really wanted to study agriculture, which was very unusual for women back then. Most women went into home economics or education. So she had some professors that really sort of helped her along and encouraged her. So she graduated in 1920 as the first female landscape architect in Michigan.
Wow.
So that was her early education career. Yeah, it was pretty impressive. For 2 years, she worked in a firm in Chicago. And at that time, she met P.J. Hoffmaster. He was the first state park superintendent.
What an amazing time to be working as an architect in Chicago.
Yes. If you look at her resume, she had a lot of pretty impressive parks, especially. So she met P.J. Hoffmaster and they became friends. And he actually got her to help sort of establish some of the early parks and design some of them. She scouted out locations throughout the state that she felt would make really great additions to this growing state park system. And one of the first ones that she worked on was Hartwick Pines, which is actually part of the Michigan History Center Museum system. So we are very closely associated with Hartwick Pines. So that's how she sort of got started within the park system in Michigan.
When was the period when she really put her stamp on the state parks?
You really start to see her work in the 50s. P.J. Hoffmaster died, I think somewhat unexpectedly, in 1951. And she sort of carried the torch after that, became a real champion for the state park system. She worked with citizen groups and conservation groups to not only maintain the park system, the ones that existed, but also to add to that park system. If you think about America and post-World War II, you get a lot of people who have vacation time and the ability to travel. You get the Mackinac Bridge is built in 57. So you have this ability of people to travel and go out into the state parks. And so she really started making her mark after P.J. Hoffmaster died in the 1950s and then throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
You know, this feels after the first wave of creations and commissionings of the national parks. Mm-hmm. And we know a little bit about that. But what were some of the big issues for Michigan's state parks once they were defined and named as such?
You got a few things that are going on. In the 1950s, the Michigan Parks Association is established. And that is, again, to sort of help with this organization of the park system. But by the 1960s, some of the parks are starting to show wear and tear. Parks in this state, for good or ill, sort of wane and succeed based on the economy. If there's money to maintain them and if there are people to visit them, they do very well. So in the 60s, you start to see some wear and tear on the parks. And so Gillette actually worked with the legislature to get a $100 million bond to rebuild and fix up some of the parks. She also developed a system which we now know as the Recreation Passport System. And basically, this was a vehicle permit that people would pay for so they could go into the parks. And we use that today. So those are some of the things that she came up with to sort of help maintain funds for this park system.
Did Genevieve ever end up going national with her skill set?
She did. In 1966, President Johnson appointed her as part of the Citizen Advisory Committee on Recreation and Natural Beauty. So like many federal appointments, it has a very long, it's a really long title. So she's part of that group. And it's, again, it's this system that's put into place in the 60s to help sort of revitalize this idea of visiting national and state parks. So she actually works on that commission for quite some time. And then she also stays very local. She's She's appointed to a commission by Governor Milliken, and she continues with that.
I mean, Rachel, when you look around at what we have of the state park system now, are there any things that you've ever noticed that, you know, really speak to you of what she was able to do or her commitment? I mean, the fact that they are here is something we can credit her for, but what do you think are the physical manifestations of the work that she did here?
Oh, there's so many. I've been to a lot of the state parks. I'm a DNR employee, so I don't mean to give a shout out to my own department, but the parks crew, they do an amazing job. And I think one of the biggest contributions she made and part of her legacy is just the love and appreciation for those parks and the thinking that we need to maintain them. They are important. You know, today people are using state parks more and more just to kind of get out. And I don't know what the statistic is, but there's something about you are X number of miles from a state park at any given point. There are a lot of them. And I think her legacy is just the fact that they are here, but they're maintained so beautifully and they offer so many different experiences. No matter what you're looking for, you can find it in the state park.
Rachel Clark is with the Michigan History Center. Rachel, thank you so much for shining a light on the accomplishments of Genevieve Gillette. Now we know there was indeed a First Lady of Michigan State Parks.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Next up, Lois Beardsley spins stories from her cherry farm in the Upper Peninsula. We hope you can stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's not easy making sense of the strange, chaotic moment that we're experiencing right now. A lot of folks are turning to artists and their work for comfort as well as insight. With us now is Ojibwe writer, artist, activist, and educator Lois Beardsley. She lives near Maple City, up north, and she's just finished a poetry collection, Words Like Thunder, New and Used Anishinaabe Prayers. It addresses a whole host of current issues: how to celebrate, how to console, and how to cope. Lois Beardsley, welcome to Stateside. Would you mind telling us the story of where your writing began?
Oh my gosh. I went away and lived in the Southwest for a while, and then I came home and I was credentialed in education, and I couldn't get a job sweeping the floors in a school. So I fell back on the survival art that my mother and my grandmother had done, doing quill work and traditional baskets, things like that. And I started writing and doing some storytelling to sell the artwork, basically. And it started out, you know, sort of the traditional stories out of context that were expected by a non-Native audience. And one day I was approached by a colleague to help with a textbook about stereotypes in children's literature. And it changed me and changed my approach to writing. And I dragged my feet. I fought it the whole way. No, I can't do that. You know, I have to live in this community. I can't write about racism. I can't write about stereotypes. But those things kind of crept into my writing. I still wrote primarily for a non-Native audience, but used tradition to sort of lure in the audience. And then I was able to sneak in references to socioeconomic realities and the apartheid that still continues around Native communities. And the more political and sort of outspoken I got, the more I started getting bidding wars over my manuscripts, and I started winning a lot of awards for writing and for civil rights. And Words Like Thunder falls into that genre a little bit. I write for two audiences. There are a lot of inside jokes. There's a lot of Native language in there that I don't translate. But it's still geared to be user-friendly and a pleasant experience for a non-Native audience.
Right. Again, the book's full title is Words Like Thunder, New and Used Anishinaabe Prayers. I just love that. How did the sort of subtitle New and Used Prayers come to you?
Because I use the traditional stories very often in updated forms to show how our traditional culture and traditional approaches are so powerful, so competent, and so flexible that they help us continue to function today. So stories will be updated. I might have a reference to Doritos in a traditional story. And so if the prayers are new and used, it's because these stories have adapted, always adapted. And traditional stories deal with everything that humankind confronts.
There's a figure woven into the thread of this collection, Folded Over Woman. You know, she's a figure who sometimes seems to be folded over because she's looking for important things and sustaining things. And it seems that sometimes she's bent over by the weight of her life or things that
exactly.
She's thinking about.
Exactly.
Yeah. Would you tell me about her?
Well, I write nonfiction as well as fiction and have written for peer-reviewed scholarly journals. And one statistic that stands out in my mind is that at the turn of this 21st century, the ethnic group with the highest number of college diplomas in the state of Michigan was Native American women. But the group with the highest unemployment was also Native American women, followed by Native American men. And Folded Over Woman is sort of a metaphor for the things that Native people and women in particular confront. You know, part of socioeconomic apartheid, there's a strong mental and emotional component to it that involves getting people to accept their role as second-class citizens. And Folded Over Woman keeps trying to unfold herself. She keeps fighting that system. She knows when to bend over, keep her head down low, but she still just rises up and reaches skyward. And I feel like I am that way a little bit with my writing. My work is very, very popular in the Native American community and among Native scholars because I'm always poking my finger out there. I'm always looking for boundaries.
Would you read for us?
I'd be delighted. So I really enjoy gleaning wild foods. I grew up doing it. I grew up back and forth between northern Michigan and northern Ontario. So I pick strawberries. I have a beautiful strawberry patch right behind the house. And crows nest every year right at the edge of that spot. And the crows often feel challenged by my presence. And the first thing they'll do is caw. First, the mother will swoop down, and then the father will swoop down several times, very close. But crows are able to mimic other animals and other sounds. So when swooping and cawing doesn't work, they start trying to bluff. They imitate other sounds that have intimidated them in the past. So they'll bark, they'll growl like a bear or a dog or a wolf, and they'll imitate chainsaws and tractors. So that's one of the backup stories. And then I live in Leelanau County, and there is a very well-documented hate crime that happened against a Native family. And it started with the abduction of a 13-year-old child from an after-school sporting event. But nothing ever happened. And the families, it went on for years with dead animals left on their doorstep and things. And the family's only recourse was a Title IX suit in federal court against the school district because it actually accelerated to the point that it included inappropriate sexual contact by an adult in front of multiple witnesses at the school. this battered family ended up pitting themselves against a multi-billion dollar insurance corporation representing the school districts. So this child who was clawing open sores into his skin and pulling out his hair and had stopped eating and almost died, took a small settlement, fled, and completely vanished, just disappeared. It was the only way to keep the family safe. So I took the mother of this child in this poem, which is a short but very beautiful poem, took the mother of this child and inserted her into the strawberry patch. So I've got a little comparison going on with this contemporary Ojibwe family and the Crow family, who are afraid of the person picking the berries. So here we go. And Odemnigesis is the month of the picking wild strawberries, heart berries. Odemnigesis 2. Folded over woman picks wild strawberries in the cool of low light, shaded mornings and evenings, grasping at the wingtips of solstice, spread out relentlessly before her in painful, moisture-sucking heat. Each time folded over woman passes through the shadow of Crow Mother's nest, Mother Crow calls out to her, loud and raspy, screaming in terror for the welfare of her children, relentless and desperate. Father Crow swoops down low, making a single wasteful pass before he prays out loud for survival of his offspring. And so crows growl deep and low and bear-like, left with no arsenal other than bluff and prayer. Mother and father rasp argumentatively back and forth in desperation, and Mother Crow caws out until her crow throat is dry and sterile. Folded over woman wishes she knew how to put out water or carrion where Mother Crow might feel safe enough to dip for it, to continue crying out for safety as a job, a mission, the only way she knows how to contribute to Crow children's well-being. It is what she has to do, Folded Over Woman understands. Folded Over Woman used to cry raspy and loud, crow-like, too, to protect her children, but they were plucked away from life and home by forces more malintended than mere berry-picking loners grasping berry soils or sacred bending treetops. Offspring lost to pickers of souls, pickers of children, soft and ripe, meaty and ready. Folded over woman picks wild strawberries in the shadow of croaks and desperate calls. It is her job, her mission, her only option. It is what she has to do. She only knows how to glean. There is no room between thick gusts of throaty desperation for fortune or anchoring grasses and leaves. Folded over woman can only leave enough wild strawberries for wax wings for desperate crow people. Folded over woman understands again and again. She doubles over again and again. She shares with her whole body. For a few cool morning moments, she unfolds and sings crow rasps that echo bluing skies and want for survival. No one gives Mother Crows the respect they deserve.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lois Beardsley. Her latest book is Words Like Thunder, New and Used Anishinaabe Prayers. You know, one of the main tensions that keeps coming up again and again in the book is the real contrast between the many creature comforts that you describe and the very chilling things in life. There are so many almost beautiful snapshots that you give us of just moments with relatives. And well, in this particular poem, you know, this image of a woman going picking wild strawberries, it has, you know, on the surface, it has kind of a pastoral feel, and there's an acknowledgement of, you know, a mother doing something for her offspring, and at the same time, the really raucous cry and the and the desperation that she sees happening before her. Tell me a little bit more about holding those two things in balance in the course of one poem.
Well, I guess I have two responses to that. One is that one of the things I wanted to do with this book is show the beauty of contemporary Native people. But I also want to address the way that disparity is hidden under cloaks, whether they're cloaks of stereotypes where Indians are associated with nature, and isn't it lovely to be able to pick these wild strawberries? That's how I like to see my Indians, you know,
yeah.
my Native people, my minorities, you know, associated with nature, complacent, take my venison tenderloins, please. And at the same time, reality sort of rears its ugly head. And it's very easy to say there's no apartheid in my community. Or educators often say, I don't see children of color, I only see children. You're very lucky to be able to see that world that way, because people of color wake up every day aware of who we are, aware of our status. The Hispanic author Richard Rodriguez, you know, talks about how his relatives stop at every single stop sign, even in the backwoods, even in rural areas. Look both ways because you're a person of color. You're always careful, careful, careful.
You know, in a similar way, there's a lot of, your writing does a lot of breaking down the fourth wall, saying, sometimes overtly to the reader, I'm just going to tell you a story from my past because it might make it easier for you to relate to me. And it just comes across so witty and so heartbreaking at the same time, you know, showing the work that you have to do thinking these things through. When did you realize that might be a tactic, you know, to just hit it head on?
I guess when I started wanting to make those changes was when I realized that being complacent, being someone who tries to live up to the stereotypes, okay, I'm docile, I don't need anything, I don't need the same pay, I don't need the same access to resources. There's the idea of seeing that, oh my gosh, that didn't work. You know, I've been told all my life, be patient. People of color, you need to be patient now. You know, America has to grow into change. And then seeing that, well, actually, change only happens if you keep pushing, pushing, pushing.
I don't know if there's ever really a lucrative time to be a poet, but this year does certainly seem like a time when poets have pretty important work to do, since there are so many things in the world that defy description, unless we're, I guess, using very deliberate writing as poets do. Could you tell a little bit about how poetry helps you sort things?
I've always been known for combining poetry and prose in the way that I write. And I think that that's more commonplace than we acknowledge. I think the academy has always sort of separated poetry from prose. But storytelling and theater are part of our lives, and they're certainly part of traditional cultures. You know, all traditional cultures have such a strong sense of theater, and that's part of religion, that's part of politics, it's part of coping on a daily basis and teaching our kids, using metaphors to teach safety and important life skills. You know, poetry uses rhythm, cadence, repeat, and when I do a book of poetry, I put it together as a comprehensive whole, so that if it gets pretty intense at one point, I make sure I have spaces in there for the reader to just rest, for them to stop and go, or put the book down, take a break, and then come back.
Well, I just want to thank you for bringing us to your table with this book and for the ways in which you pull back the curtain on your thinking and your stories. The book is Words Like Thunder from Lois Beardsley, and it's available from Wayne State University Press. Lois, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we're going to be talking with an elementary school teacher from Detroit who's been reading to her students every single night online. You won't want to miss this one. That's our show for today. I'm April Bear. Stay safe, and we'll see you tomorrow.